If you're like me, when you see the words Russia and evangelical together in a headline, you expect to read something about the ways Moscow has tried to make common cause with the American conservative evangelical movement. Maybe something about how Vladimir Putin paints Russia as a bastion of traditional values, or how figures like Marjorie Taylor Greene or Tucker Carlson are repeating Russian talking points. So I admit I did a double take when I saw the title of writer Peter Pomerantsev's article, Russia's War Against Evangelicals, in Time magazine last month. The war he's referring to isn't a disinformation campaign or influence operation against American evangelicals. It's Russia's systemic persecution of Ukrainian evangelicals in occupied parts of Ukraine. To borrow some figures cited in the article, according to the Institute for the Study of War, Protestants have been the victims of 34% of religious persecution events recorded in occupied Ukraine since the start of the full-scale invasion, despite representing only about 2-4% of Ukraine's population. These persecution events include the destruction of churches, interrogations, imprisonments, and murders, among other things. And the reason Russia disproportionately targets evangelicals in Ukraine, Pomerantsev writes, is because it sees them as quote-unquote agents of America. Russia's persecution and violence against civilians and massive destruction of infrastructure in Ukraine is well documented, of course, but this was the first time I'd heard about Russia targeting Protestants specifically and framing this as part of what it sees as its war against the U.S. I reached out to Peter Pomerantsev for an interview about the article, but he told me the person I really wanted to speak to on this topic was a guy named Stephen Moore, a former Republican strategist who now lives in Kyiv and runs the NGO, the Ukraine Freedom Project. Moore joined me for this week's show, along with the Ukraine Freedom Project's COO, Anna Shvitsova. I also spoke to Catherine Warner, a professor of history and religious studies at Penn State University, about Ukraine's religious pluralism and how Russia has tried to stamp it out. Welcome to The Naked Pravda. Hello, I'm Stan Brazil, Medusa in English's senior news editor, and you're listening to The Naked Pravda. My first guest today is Catherine Warner, a professor of history and religious studies at Penn State University who studies religious life in Ukraine. I asked her to set the stage for our conversation by giving a general overview of Ukraine's religious landscape since 1991.
The religious landscape in Ukraine has changed drastically since the collapse of the USSR in 1991. There are many, many contributing factors, not least of which, and this is what has primarily concerned Protestants, is the fact that it became possible for American missionaries and American other kinds of religious organizations, missionaries from all different countries and religious organizations based in anywhere, to come to the former Soviet Union and, based on whatever their commitments were, to either evangelize or to provide humanitarian aid, to open up seminaries, a wide spectrum of activities became possible. The Ukrainian state, unlike many other states of the former USSR, were open to receiving a wide spectrum of religious communities and actually had fairly little restrictions in place that curbed their activities. This then, over time, led to the growth of tremendous religious pluralism in Ukraine, and overall, a tolerance for religious difference.
What do you think made the difference in Ukraine? You said, unlike other former Soviet states, what was different about Ukraine specifically?
Ukraine, of course, it's primarily an Orthodox country, but it has historically had multiple Orthodox churches. Those Orthodox churches have primarily been critics of the state, unlike Orthodox churches in other countries, including Russia, where there has been far greater degrees of cooperation between religious authorities and state authorities. One of the things that made Orthodox churches critics of the state was the fact that Orthodoxy already had to share the stage, if you will, with Greek Catholicism, which is a uniquely Eastern Christian form of Catholicism that predominates in Western Ukraine. So in Ukraine, you had, right from the start, multiple religious organizations that claimed a national allegiance, more so than a state allegiance.
So if we just list the predominant religions playing a role in Ukraine, that's Ukrainian Orthodoxy, Islam, Greek Catholicism, Protestantism. What else is in the landscape?
For starters, in terms of Orthodoxy, it's really important to note that there are multiple Orthodox churches. It's also important to note that Ukraine is very religiously active. I think aside from Muslim and Buddhist communities, there are a far greater number of a wide spectrum of religious minority communities in Ukraine than there are, for example, in Russia, even though Ukraine has a third the population of Russia. So, for example, that means that even though numerically, and it's very difficult to really put a lot of stock in these numbers, but nonetheless, numerically, approximately 4% of the population is Protestant. But this does not reflect the enormous influence and import that Protestant communities, that is to say, everything from Protestant believers to leaders of those Protestant religious organizations, the import and the influence they have on both social and political life in Ukraine. Similarly, the Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church numbers approximately 10% of the population. Having said that, again, that in no way reflects the presence and the access to the kind of transnational resources that the Catholic Church offers. In both of those instances, specifically sticking with those two examples, Protestant communities and Ukrainian Greek Catholic communities, it also does not reflect just how active and vibrant those communities are on a local, regional, and then by extension on a national level.
Do you think this is because of the culture of these religions, or is it the fact, I mean, I assume Protestantism is newer in Ukraine? I'm still kind of curious about what makes them play an outsized role.
I don't think it has to do with the faith themselves, because of course there are Protestants in Russia as well. And they of course have taken a totally different stance than the Protestants in Ukraine. And of course the Catholic Church has an entirely different position within Russian society, and the Russian regime views the Catholic Church very differently than does, say, the Ukrainian ruling authorities. I think, if anything, it goes back to the fact that Ukraine as a borderland, as a meeting point of multiple empires, the Austro-Hungarian, Russian, and Ottoman, means that there has historically been tremendous religious diversity in Ukraine. And although it often is concentrated in certain regional areas, it's not exclusively in certain regions. In other words, when one thinks of Protestants, for example, of course they can be found across Ukraine. But if anything, they had a pronounced presence in eastern Ukraine, in Donbas, in precisely those occupied territories today. In terms of Islam, you're right, there are indigenous peoples, the Crimean Tatars, who are Muslim, many of whom then have relocated to Ukraine after 2014, and have been, that Muslim community then is compounded then by, for example, citizens of other former republics of the Soviet Union, Azerbaijan, various Central Asian countries, who, and Ukraine has been a tremendous recipient of Afghan immigrants, who are located then across the country. So in other words, although there might have been these historic regional strongholds, I think few people would argue that religious minority communities are grounded in certain regions. They all have managed to make a national presence for themselves.
So starting in maybe, let's say, 2014 to 2022, what did Russia's targeting of Protestants in eastern Ukraine look like? What forms did it take?
The targeting of Protestant communities in what are now the occupied territories took many forms. For starters, Donetsk, for example, had what was called a Christian university, one of the largest seminaries in all of the former Soviet Union, that drew people from all over the former Soviet Union to it as students. It had a large publishing house and a variety of other administrative and organizational centers. So those were, of course, instantly closed and then eventually crushed. So in other words, there was an attempt to just instantaneously shut down the infrastructure of evangelical communities. That was then followed by then the targeting of specific communities and specific religious leaders. There are now documented cases of torture against Protestant believers and Protestant clergy. This has then taken now a third phase where, although the greatest number of religiously affiliated buildings that have been destroyed are connected with the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, which is under the Moscow Patriarchate, the second greatest number of buildings, because they so predominated in what are now the occupied territories, are of course Protestant prayer houses and other buildings that are affiliated with Protestant religious organizations. So it's been a multi-tiered strategy that has systematically targeted this minority religious community. And this targeting is justified by the fact that they are not simply traitors to the nation, but traitors to the faith.
Could you talk about this traitors idea a bit and the logic or the ideas that Russia uses to justify targeting Protestants?
The logic of being a traitor stems from the fact that, you know, the whole Ruski Mir idea trades on the fact that if one is an Eastern Slav, one is Orthodox. To be Russian is to be Orthodox. To be Ukrainian is to be Orthodox. It is not to be Protestant. And of course, historically, I mean, Protestant communities, and specifically Baptists, got their foothold in Ukraine and more broadly in the Russian Empire with Catherine the Great, who specifically brought in German pietists to farm the land. This then developed into, eventually, a confessional group, the Baptists, and then that splintered off into Pentecostals, and then later splintered off into Charismatics, and so on and so on. So they have deep historical roots, but those communities were formed primarily by converting Orthodox believers or non-practicing Orthodox to Protestantism. Perhaps you and your listeners will recall that during the Russian imperial period, people were primarily designated by religious affiliation as to who they were. That was more important than, say, any kind of national designation. And so, of course, by and large, the people in the territory that is now Ukraine were designated as Orthodox. And so those who then deviated from that norm were then seen as traitors both to the nation, to the faith, and then by extension to the state. In the Soviet period, of course, Protestantism was closely allied with American, specifically American capitalist interests. So it took on a further negative cast, which remained rather robust throughout the entire Soviet period, when there were strong negative stereotypes about Protestants.
So Russia has, of course, people of a lot of different faiths too, and its state policy formally allows for religions that aren't Russian Orthodox Christianity. But of course, it strictly regulates how religion can be practiced inside of Russia. The Institute for the Study of War says the Russian authorities systematically repress religious liberty in Russia as a matter of state policy. This is well documented. Can you talk a bit about to what extent Moscow's religious persecution in Ukraine is an extension of its policies back in Russia?
I think it clearly is. I mean, it's specifically those kinds of policies that one seeks to import into Ukrainian territories under the justification of a Ruski Mir, kind of a ideologically induced policy. The only problem is that against the backdrop of war, it takes on, well, lethal dimensions. I mean, one doesn't simply regulate those communities, one destroys them. One doesn't simply regulate and oblige registration and the like, those communities are leveled.
A lot of media attention is given in the U.S. to Ukraine's sanctions, investigations, and legislation surrounding the Ukrainian Orthodox Church of the Moscow Patriarchate, which has historically been subordinate to the Russian Orthodox Church. Could you talk about the difficulty for Ukraine of maintaining religious freedom while trying to take appropriate security measures regarding a church with alleged ties to the country waging a war against it?
This is an excruciatingly difficult question for Ukraine, for Ukrainian believers, and most of all for the clergy of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church of the Moscow Patriarchate. They have declared themselves alternatively autonomous, independent. They've used a variety of words. But at the end of the day, technically, if we want to get very legalistic, they are still institutionally connected to the Russian Orthodox Church, a position that is increasingly not tenable for many believers and many clergy. Having said that, the situation is sort of stalled, I would say, because while there is a pronounced commitment to democratic forms of government, and there has been a pronounced stated commitment to maintaining religious freedom, religious tolerance, and religious pluralism, on one level, one would like to see respect for all religious institutions. It does become difficult and open to challenge when, for example, the Kyiv-Pechersk Lavra in the capital of Kyiv, which had been leased to the Ukrainian Orthodox Church of the Moscow Patriarchate, when that lease expired, the question then stood before the Ukrainian government, which then maintains the lease on the land, should that lease be extended or not. They decided not to extend it to the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, which is under the Moscow Patriarchate. And that decision came after a search was made of the premises, and one can debate how many numbers of Russian passports are acceptable, how many are not, how much cash on hand is acceptable, how much is not. But certain things, such as clergy holding two passports, materials that propagate the Russian world, and other kinds of views that are anathema to what the Ukrainian state and what the majority, I think, of the Ukrainian people would like to see realized in their country. The question then becomes, what does one do with those individuals that propagate those ideas, that perhaps in some instances collaborate with Russian authorities? And by extension, what does one do with the institution to which they're formally affiliated? These are very, very, very vexed questions. It's important to note that prior to 2022, if you think in terms of the number of communities, the largest number was by far the Ukrainian Orthodox Church of the Moscow Patriarchate. But since the Maidan in 2014, the willingness of individuals to state an affiliation with this institution has fallen. And after 2022 and the beginning of the full-scale Russian invasion, it fell catastrophically. And so now the levels of stated affiliation are very, 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 very low among the Ukrainian Orthodox Church of the Moscow Patriarchate. So it remains something of a shell of an institution.
I know you're not working in Eastern Ukraine right now, but if you have any insight on this topic from people you know, surely there are still Protestants living in occupied Ukrainian territory despite all of this. Do you know what it currently looks like for them to practice their faith? Are people meeting in secret? Are there any churches that are still allowed to operate?
Well, what I do know is wrenchingly sad, namely that, shelling continues. missiles continued to fall. And this means that, for example, the electricity constantly goes out, the heat constantly goes out, there's highly sporadic internet access. All of this makes that in and of itself would make for tremendous logistical complications for anyone to gather, to practice religion or to do anything else. So one has to look at religious life such as it is in that region, first and foremost, against the backdrop of violence and the risk of life and enormous, enormous, enormous discomfort and enormous challenges in terms of communication. Having said all of that, many Protestant members of Protestant communities continue to provide forms of humanitarian aid in those areas where it's possible to cross the border. That's an another issue. The extensive mining in the region has very significantly impaired the ability to cross the border. Ukraine is now the single most heavily mined patch of earth on the planet. And so it's very it's difficult to know where one can go, which roads are in fact passable, which fields are in fact passable, and the like. So this is yet another complication. Having said that, I do believe small-scale forms of informal exchange and encounter are occurring, but it's against the backdrop of enormous, enormous suffering and enormous, enormous difficulties. I don't know to what extent this is of interest to you, but you know, these Baptist communities used to be pacifist. And in Russia, they still remain that. But in Ukraine, they have by and large rethought that fundamental religious conviction. And many are serving in the armed forces. Many are serving as chaplains, but many are also serving as soldiers. So that's been also another tremendous change to these communities. It has fundamentally altered what they believe in.
My next guests are Stephen Moore, the founder of the humanitarian aid organization, the Ukraine Freedom Project, and Anna Shvitsova, the project's COO. Stephen is a former chief of staff in the U.S. House of Representatives, and he's been in Ukraine since day five of the full-scale war, while Anna is originally from eastern Ukraine and was managing a marketing agency before joining Stephen shortly after the full-scale invasion. In addition to the Ukraine Freedom Project, Stephen and Anna run a website called RussiaTorturesChristians.org, where they share information about Russia's targeting of evangelical Christians in Ukraine. I asked Stephen what made him decide to go to Ukraine as soon as the full-scale war began.
I lived in Ukraine in 2018 and 2019, had a great time, loved it. Kyiv's a beautiful city. And what I like about Ukraine is what I like about America, because the Ukrainians are entrepreneurial, hardworking. They love freedom, and frankly, more than America does. And they're just good people who want to be left alone from the Russians. And that's the story of Ukraine. And it's a great story. And after I left Ukraine, I got a job with a U.S. artificial intelligence company that had about 500 Ukrainian employees. And so I had all these Ukrainian friends and was really into the Ukrainian story. And for me personally, freedom is one of my core values. And so it really resonated with me that the Ukrainians are such freedom-loving people. And so I left the artificial intelligence company on January 31st, 2022. And I'm sitting at my mom's house in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and I'm trying to figure out like really weighty things. Like, should I spend the rest of the winter skiing in the Alps or skiing in the Rockies? And then my friends from Ukraine started calling me and saying things like, they're bombing Kyiv. I don't know what to do. And I had spent nearly 2 years in Iraq at the beginning of that war as a civilian. And so I know what to do. So I hopped on a plane. I landed in Bucharest and drove to Chernivtsi, which is a small city on the Romanian border, and started trying to help. And, you know, we got a bunch of humanitarian aid to the front, a couple million dollars. And actually, we're just now getting another container full of medical goods over there that's probably going to be worth another $1 million. So we're doing a lot of humanitarian work still. But, you know, now I think what Ani and I are doing is what I've done all my life, which is, you know, telling opinion leaders and the American public the truth about what's going on in Ukraine. And I've been changing public opinion my entire life. And so we're now, in addition to the humanitarian work, trying to push back against the Russian propaganda and educate folks in the United States about what we're seeing in Ukraine.
When we started doing it, there were not many testimonies of people. There were some researches, but not information, not a lot of coverage, almost no coverage in the media. That is why you maybe didn't hear about it until recently. And we hired two teams of people to find people who survived Russian captivity. It was not easy, and the hardest part was to make them speak publicly about what they've been through. It requires courage, both because it's painful and for them it's hard to talk to, but also if they have people either from their church or their relatives left on the occupied territories, it puts them into danger because Russians will be persecuting these people afterwards, the Russian troops. So these people, every testimony you find on our website and people to tell, they are very brave people.
The Russian Orthodox Church is not a church like most of us would think of a church. It is a working arm of the Kremlin. And so, you know, Patriarch Kirill has said, if you die fighting in Ukraine, all your sins will be washed away. Now, he stopped short of offering 72 virgins, but, you know, the concept is the same. And, you know, and what you find, if you go right now and Google Russian Orthodox priest blessing tanks and put on the images search, you will find pictures, about 100 pictures of guys in robes with beards sprinkling holy water on weapons of war. So that's where the Russian Orthodox Church is coming from. So you've got the Russian soldiers coming into occupied Ukraine. They're occupying these areas of Ukraine, and they see Baptists, they see Pentecostals, and they say, these are American religions. You must be agents of the American government, like our guys are agents of the Kremlin. And so they arrest them, they interrogate them, they frequently torture them, and say, sometimes murder them.
So I got to ask this. There seems to be an obvious contradiction here. The Russian state is persecuting and murdering evangelical Christians in Ukraine for their alleged Americanness or connections to the U.S., while in the U.S., in really casual political discourse, evangelical has become somewhat of a synonym for a major political faction that's arguably the most sympathetic or the most sort of interested in Putin and Russia. I don't mean to say that a majority of Republicans support Russia or anything like that, but, you know, the biggest profile Russia sympathizers often associate themselves with the Republican Party. Do you have any thoughts about how this happened?
Better than thoughts, we have data. And the data that we have, so we've done two polls of Republican primary voters. And for your viewers that are not familiar, these are the people that are like kind of the hardcore Republican voters. And they're the people that get Republicans elected to Congress. And some of the stuff we found is that, as one example, 24% of Republican voters would agree with the statement, Russia is a country that promotes and protects traditional family values. And we also polled seven different statements that were factually inaccurate and traceable to Russia, so Russian propaganda. And we found that 34% of Republican voters agreed with at least one of the statements that we polled. And so 34% of Republican primary voters have been exposed to Russian propaganda. And, you know, and when you ask them their news source, it's not anything that's complicated. It's Tucker Carlson, it's Candace Owens, it's Marjorie Taylor Greene, you know, and so ironically, for the negative, you know, Fox News gets a lot of heat, but actually their viewers are more likely to support Ukraine and not be impacted by Russian propaganda. And so there's an information war that we're all in right now. And this is part of the kinetic wars in Israel and Ukraine. And you know, the Russians, according to the American Foreign Policy Council, spend between $1.5 billion and $2.4 billion on propaganda worldwide every year. And we're seeing that, and that's impacting conservatives in the United States. So contrast that with our budget, where, you know, we spent the last 6 months telling Republicans, telling Americans that Russia tortures Christians. And we're up against massive, massive amounts of money being spent against us. And I'll tell you just one more thing about that. You know, Marjorie Taylor Greene says that Russia is protecting Christianity. You know, Tucker Carlson says that Zelensky is persecuting Christians, as does Candace Owen. And I don't know what their motivations are, but I do know this, that you can document a group of lobbyists on Capitol Hill who were paid by a Russian-Ukrainian oligarch to give that message to members of Congress, because you've got to, if you register to lobby, you've got to document where your money comes from. And a group called Nelson Mullins, which is a big law firm and lobbying firm in South Carolina, is being paid by a guy named Robert Amsterdam, who's a kind of the lawyer of last resort. His other clients include Kim.com and the government of Venezuela. And he is being paid by a guy named Vadim Novensky, who is a Russian oligarch that moved to Ukraine under the Yanukovych administration, where they gave him Ukrainian citizenship and gave him a seat in parliament. And he became known as Putin's whip because he was so fervent about forwarding the Kremlin agenda in the Ukrainian parliament. And he is currently a deacon in the Russian Orthodox Church in Switzerland. So I don't know what motivates Tucker Carlson. I don't know what motivates Marjorie Taylor Greene, but there is Russian money behind their message on Capitol Hill. The unfortunate thing is that, you know, having been, you know, listen, I've worked for Republicans all my life, and, you know, there's been, you know, when Hunter Biden's laptop was discovered in this Delaware repair shop, the Democrats said, oh, this is a, you know, Russian propaganda plot. And it turned out it wasn't. So what happens is that it's difficult for me then to explain when actual Russian propaganda is found in the media. And so that's kind of a, you know, the boy who cried wolf story, right? So that's hard to deal with.
You are a former Republican strategist. Politico called you the GOP's man in Kyiv. What is it like for you to kind of be going against the grain of some of the loudest folks in your party? And I mean, I'm sure you have a lot of acquaintances who disagree with you on this, or maybe who you hear repeating disinformation. What has that been like the last 2.5 years?
I have visited with probably 100 congressional offices over the period of like 5 or 6 months. And some of them are pretty aggressive. There's three types of offices. There are the offices that are going to vote for Ukraine no matter what. There's about, you know, 100 of those folks. There's the 70 or so folks that will never vote for Ukraine. And there's this middle ground of members of Congress that would like to vote for Ukraine, but their constituents, their voters, have been infected by this Russian propaganda and are just, you know, yelling at them about nonsense. Zelensky's a Nazi. Again, Zelensky's persecuting Christians. Or Zelensky bought 2 yachts with American money. And, you know, and this is all demonstrably false. So the offices in that 70 that will never vote for Ukraine, those people get pretty animated. I've actually had 2 members of Congress yell in my face about this. And so, you know, I've worked on campaigns for much of my life, and there's a high correlation between the candidate or cause that spends the most money and the candidate or cause that wins. And, you know, the Russians have, you know, orders of magnitude more money than we do. So it's not surprising to me that people who have been impacted by that are not really willing to listen to someone who is counter to their worldview.
Do you ever imagine an alternate reality where you happen not to have gone to Ukraine, but you have your same background, where you personally are more susceptible to Russian disinformation, like some Republicans in the U.S.? Do you think that would have been possible?
I have a high opinion of my ability to think critically. Maybe it's unwarranted, but I said I've gone to Iraq, I've gone to Indonesia after 2001. I worked in Congress, and the reason that I like doing these things is I want to find out for myself what's really going on, you know. So I now know what happens in those smoky back rooms in Congress. You know, I know, you know, from the ground of what happened in Iraq when we went in there in 2003. I know what the largest Muslim country in the world was thinking shortly after September 11, 2001. And so I wouldn't trade these experiences for anything. And that's what motivates me.
Anna, I asked Stephen what it's like to be opposing some of his party's loudest voices. What is it like for you when you're visiting D.C., presumably interacting with a lot of people who buy into disinformation about what's happening in Ukraine, or maybe who are even sympathetic to Russia? It sounds like that's a big part of your job.
It is hard, but America is democracy, and people who are responsible for the public affairs, for the politics in America, they listen to their constituents and other people. That's the advantage of working with Americans in American politics. Even if they don't have good information, some of them, they're willing to change their opinion if they are given good information from trusted sources, factual-based information. So rewarding for listening to you. So that's my experience.
Thanks for tuning in, folks. This has been The Naked Pravda, a podcast from Medusa in English. Remember that undesirable status back in Russia means our entire news outlet now relies on readers and listeners around the world to support our work. Please visit our website for information about how to become a contributor with one-time or recurring pledges. Thanks again. Until next week.